the international slot, I think I would be remiss if I didn't just acknowledge the crisis in the last few days in Pakistan, the state of emergency, and particularly for those of us who work in the human rights field, one of our close colleagues, Asma Jahangir, who's really an extraordinary human rights lawyer, was put under house arrest yesterday, and she's a fearless advocate for human rights, for women's rights, for health, and civil society in Pakistan. So I just want to acknowledge that before going into the crisis in Darfur. We are a national organization of health professionals and do investigations and advocacy, as well as training, which I'll mention just briefly before the end of my presentation. And I urge any of you who want to follow our work on Darfur to go onto our website, which I think will pop up at the end, because we have a Darfur survival campaign for people who want to take some form of action about this crisis. So I'm going to just do a brief overview, and it's going to be really cursory, sort of recap of some of the things I presented last year for those of you who haven't been following this crisis closely, and then a very short update on the current humanitarian situation. And I do want to leave you with a glimmer of hope, because things are pretty grim right now as we speak, and unfortunately unraveling since a year ago even further. So just a quick recap of the crisis. We don't know the mortality rate. It's actually something that's quite in dispute and debated, but it's at least a minimum of 200,000 Darfurians have been killed. Hundreds of non-Arab villages in this western region of what is the largest country by landmass in Africa have been destroyed. And more than 2.8 million people displaced, many inside Sudan, inside Darfur itself, and a great many who have now crossed the border into Chad, into neighboring Chad, and whose lives continue to be at risk. Right now, there are hundreds of thousands who are at risk of disease and malnutrition, because as insecurity becomes even more complicated in the past year, there are numerous villages and towns, some of them as large as 100,000 people, who are unreachable by humanitarian aid workers. Just to quickly look at this region, you can see how large Sudan is. Darfur is, the map on the right, this blocked out region on the left. It's as large as Texas or France, whichever one you choose. And it is bordered by Chad, the Central African Republic, which is now also bursting with conflict, unfortunately, and Libya in the north, which has been trying to host failed peace agreements in the last 2 weeks. Much of Darfur, where I had the privilege to visit last year, is very sandy and full of and lacks vegetation, water challenges, etc. But there are regions of Darfur that are actually quite fertile good for agriculture. So I'm really not going to spend a lot of time on this, but the conflict has been brewing in this part of Sudan for decades. It primarily, this conflict emerged because of neglect of this region by the central government, ethnic conflict between the dominating ethnicity in Sudan, so-called Arabs, usually people who self-identify that way, and what the group, dominant group, considers to be the racially inferior African tribal groups, or blacks, often referred to in the language as blacks or slaves. Of course, there has been a conflict over resources for many, many decades. These Janjaweed militias that the government of Sudan has armed since this conflict, the latest version of this conflict, erupted in the early 2000s and climaxed in 2003 with some attacks by rebels on an outpost of the government in the north Darfur, has resulted in this horrific scorched earth policy. Literally hundreds of villages have been converted from what you see on the left to what you see on the right. And the destruction has actually been total and devastating, so that entire villages have literally been burned to the ground, water supplies, wells poisoned, livestock essential for survival in Darfur, plundered, pillaged, sold on the markets in the region, and or killed, as in that case, or left to die. and huge losses for the livelihoods and economies of the people. This is just an example of what one family suffered, losing half their household population and well over three quarters of their livestock. And of course, you know that this conflict has also been accompanied by a tactic of this war, which is mass rape. We work with colleagues in Sudan, who I'll mention in a minute, who continue to treat the survivors of sexual violence and torture in Darfur. It is a strategy of the war to rid people. It's a terror tactic, and women are raped, and then everybody flees the village, children as well, and grandmothers, women over 60 and 70 have also been raped. The problem right now is that for 3 years we have been asking, and governments and activists have been seeking an international peacekeeping force, and in the absence of an effective force, violence has increased dramatically inside the camps, and it's a volatile situation right now as we speak. There continue to be attacks into these camps, both in Chad and inside Darfur, and very often the cattle herders come in, enter the camps, raid and plunder, as well as abduct women, rape them, often leave them outside the camps to die. Alarming situation. This is the largest humanitarian operation outside of whatever you might consider what's going on in Iraq in the world. And so there are huge numbers of non-governmental organizations and governments providing aid because there are almost 3 million people in Darfur and in Chad dependent on international food aid. So as the conflict unravels internally, more and more places are what the UN would consider, or World Food Program, no-go areas that are just unreachable. And so the misery is extraordinary. I mean, most people are living in shelters like this or less in a brutally harsh climate. And people are waiting, usually in lines, for hours and hours for water, small amounts of water, and we're starting to see now much higher rates of malnutrition in 2007 than the aid organizations documented in 2006. So most of these people who are in these camps want to go back. They're waiting for security, and the security has not arrived. And so people continue to live this precarious situation, enormously vulnerable. So right now, we have the African Union on the ground, 7,000 of them, unable really to keep any kind of peace. They don't have a mandate to stop attacks. We had an agreement signed a year ago. It has totally unraveled, largely because those people who are representing or claim to represent the victims have not wanted to come to the peace table. And so many aid groups have evacuated in the last year, and that is with the government also, a government of Sudan threatening aid groups, obstructing aid, sometimes attacking and arresting aid workers. But it's important to note that as well now, some of the rebel groups, which have splintered into as many as some people think 28 rebel groups, are also attacking aid workers and other groups inside Darfur. So the situation is extremely volatile and really quite frightening. What's more, right now, in the last year, aid organizations have noted that nomads have now been crossing into, this is the first time in 5 years we've seen this, crossing into Darfur and taking over the villages that Darfurians have fled. Most Darfurians do expect and hope to come back to their villages. They're very tied to their land and their communities. But now these villages are, for the first time, having been left abandoned for 5 years, being taken over. And people think that the government of Sudan is encouraging this takeover of these villages. And that could also increase the violence that we'll see in the future, unless these peacekeepers that have been authorized, 26,000 have been authorized, arrive. They have not yet arrived. It's believed that about 800 of the first are supposed to be on their way, but most people don't expect a deployment until 2008. Those of you who followed the news saw that in the last 2 weeks, Libya was hosting peace talks, and the rebels didn't show up. There's this very sad picture in the New York Times the other day of a rebel eating in a hotel. I don't know if many of you saw this. The huge spread for the peace talks, and he's dressed in his full rebel guard, and nobody else showed up. So he's got the whole hotel to himself. They didn't show up because most of the rebel groups will not discuss peace until there's security. And we have this dilemma now. Is it peace talks first, followed by security, or is it going to be a secure force that comes in and gives the rebels confidence that they can trust a negotiation that will involve ultimately protection for their people? And it's a huge dilemma. The other demand of the rebels right now and civil society, such as it exists in Darfur, is compensation for these huge losses. This is what they've lost: their food, their livestock, their grain, their money, their jewelry, all their possessions, and they want something back from the government. And this will be a demand for reparation. It's something that people are owed as a human rights matter. So what are the current issues we have today? I'm just going to list some of the questions. We don't have all the answers. But there's a discussion out there now that this is no longer genocide. We had genocide in 2003 and 2004, but right now it's really erupted into a civil war. And what does this mean for those of us who work on human rights and policy? We can't just pretend that there wasn't this horrific set of attacks that resulted in ethnic cleansing and the destruction, really, of an entire way of life and community. There are international laws and an international criminal court that require that perpetrators be brought to justice in this environment. One of the people for whom there's an arrest warrant out right now by the International Criminal Court is the Minister of Humanitarian Affairs of the government of Sudan. He is responsible for allowing aid to go in and out and for overseeing the entire humanitarian operation for the government. But he is a war criminal, and the International Criminal Court has called for his arrest. So this is a big dilemma, and those of us seeking justice, as my organization does, would like this man arrested. There are those who say that if he's arrested, it will also create more tension and more violence. We have a dilemma there. There are delays in the UN force. There's also a question as to whether the Western governments and other governments in Africa are willing to contribute peacekeepers to this dangerous environment. We have aid workers who are attacked and organizations that are afraid to send their aid workers in. But I just want to give you a comment from one of the local aid workers who said, and he said this just in a comment to Doctors Without Borders a couple weeks ago, people talk about the danger on the roads. People are scared every day. But if we stop taking food, the people will die. They are our people, and I am willing to risk my life to continue to feed them. We have other international forces at play: China's investment and extraction of huge amounts of oil from Sudan, and what does that mean in terms of its influence on the government of Sudan? You've probably seen activists talking about the so-called Genocide Olympics, using that as a tool to pressure China to do the right thing and urge Sudan to allow the peacekeepers in and to stop attacking the villages. And we have political agendas of many of the players in the region, which are complex. We also have an environment, and I'm sure those of you who've seen this now in the news for 5 years and going and looking at the rest of the world may be tired of this. But I want to leave you as I finish with some cause for hope. I was in Darfur last summer training with Sudanese colleagues who are human rights activists, lawyers, physicians, social workers, psychologists. We don't hear about them much here. We hear about the international aid workers. But these people, along with the many women's groups that have emerged in Darfur in response to the attacks on women and the attacks on families that have resulted in many female-headed households, are starting to develop a civil society in Darfur in the middle of this war. And it's really encouraging to see emergence of a new kind of civil society in this remote area of the world. This was a training session we did. The man, there's a police officer there who came to our session to learn about torture because he had never gotten training on how to document and oppose torture. These are some of our colleagues in Darfur. They're just amazing people who are treating survivors of the violence, who are treating trauma victims, who are treating rape survivors. And one of them next week will be here in Washington, a leading physician, Dr. Mohammed Ahmed, to receive the Robert F. Kennedy Memorial Human Rights Award, which he will receive from Senator Kennedy in the Senate. And what he said at our session last year was this: the rebels and fighters have the arms, The civilians are innocent, and this is our responsibility. We have to be one community, and we have to stand against this together. We're fully qualified professional people, mental health professionals. If we don't address this as professionals, we will lose our society. He's an amazingly courageous man, and you'll learn more about him on our website as well. He is there to protect these women, treat them, also prosecute the perpetrators of rape and attacks. And for me, this is the hope of the future of Darfur and also of Sudan. So continue to monitor this. There are things you can do to make a difference, and I hope you'll join with us to help see a Sudan at peace with justice.
We want to thank Dr. Sergin and ask if we have any questions. We have time for one question. Yes.
Absolutely. This is something that we've seen in Rwanda, in Sierra Leone, in Congo, in Bosnia. The generation of children that have seen literally unspeakable horrors, and I did not show you the horrors that have happened. Women who've been branded, people who've had cigarettes burned on their chests, and people who've actually been physically mutilated, genitals mutilated, etc. And kids have seen all this and the killings. And one of the biggest challenges in response to these sorts of crises for the local health professional world as well as international is mental health. And we don't invest enough in it. Humanitarian organizations try to do what they can, but there's not enough funding for this. And just to give you an example, in Darfur, there are 2 psychiatrists in the entire region, 2. There are almost no psychologists. So it's really paraprofessionals who are going to need to be doing this, community workers, religious leaders, et cetera,